The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. If you've been hearing about facial recognition technology more and more lately, it is not a coincidence. It is pervasive and is embedded in technology and applications we use every day. It is the Face ID feature that opens up the home screen on your iPhone. It is a security feature your bank requires to give you access to your account. It is a helpful aid for tagging photos of your friends on Facebook or recognizing and automatically organizing your selfies. Not only is it becoming ubiquitous, it is also improving rapidly. According to tests by the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, between 2014 and 2018, facial recognition systems have gotten 20 times better at finding a match in a database of 12 million photos. Advances in big data, deep neural networks, faster and more powerful graphic processing units, or GPUs, traditionally used for faster rendering in gaming applications, have been the technical engine driving this acceleration. But applications such as Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and others, and our proclivity to take and share photos and videos have provided the massive data trove of images on which to train and refine the tech. So how does it work? Simply put, facial recognition technology trains a computer to recognize a face and its distinguishing features and use it to identify and match that to an individual in a larger data set. The first step is to recognize what is a face in various angles. Deep neural networks or algorithms are used to map the face using the distance between various facial features, such as eyes, nose, mouth, chin, and ears. The next step is to use a large data set and train a second neural network to distinguish one set of unique facial characteristics from another and match it as best as it can to one face within the data set. Facial recognition technology has been used by entities as varied as Taylor Swift for identifying potential stalkers at her concert, to Scotland Yard for identifying violent criminals, to the Chinese government for the surveillance and repression of the ethnic Muslim Uyghur community. While debate is raging about its use, what matters most is that we understand its intended and unintended consequences to start. Our guest today is Dahlia Peterson. Dahlia is a research analyst at Georgetown Center for Security and Emerging Technology. Her research focuses on facial intelligence and its use, and particularly how China harnesses predictive policing algorithms and facial, voice, and gait recognition technologies for its AI-powered surveillance programs, and the role of Western companies in aiding China's surveillance state. Welcome, Dahlia.
Indeed, welcome.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
So, clearly you've done a lot of research into China's use of the technology, and we don't want to stay focused entirely on China, but we can't not go there. Can you talk just a little bit about what you've found in China's use of the technology?
Yes, absolutely. So China is clearly the world leader in developing and piloting and deploying facial recognition technologies. And it has a clearly a clear drive to do so, not only to map people that it considers focus personnel, so those are political dissidents, ethnic minorities, or those who they otherwise think they need to scrutinize, but also the drive is really focused on everyone across China, where the goal is to be able to, in theory at least, map this on with big data and connect this seamlessly across government databases to really keep tabs on everyone in China. So China is projected to have over 600 million cameras by this year, One thing that I think is worth noting here is that we really do not know how many of these are facial recognition equipped and how many of these are not. Nonetheless, there are Chinese companies like Hikvision and Dahua, which are the world's two largest surveillance camera companies. And these companies not only have a very heavy footprint within China, but also outside of China. And increasingly, they are using deep learning to overcome issues that have traditionally hindered facial recognition, like poor lighting and bad angles. So what China does to implement its facial recognition surveillance comes both on government use, where it has partnerships and buys technology from the Chinese private sector, and also by the private sector's use of this technology itself. So in the sense of Chinese government surveillance programs, we can see facial recognition deployed widely in both urban and rural areas through programs such as Skynet, Safe Cities, and Sharp Eyes, just to name a few. And one thing that I want to note here is that while these programs certainly have a very wide scope and the goal is to cover everyone in China, there is still quite a significant flaw to their process in that we really do not want to hype China's capabilities and do their marketing for them. So while we are aware that China's ambitions are real, we still want to acknowledge that China still faces significant issues with data integration and being able to actually seamlessly connect facial recognition data with big data.
Wow, that's a lot. And as Alexa alluded to in the intro, there are concerns that Western companies and even Western academia are wittingly or unwittingly helping the Chinese state. So how is that happening, and what are the implications?
Yes, absolutely. So it is undeniable that Western companies are providing core hardware to Chinese surveillance companies. So Chinese surveillance companies have clearly admitted that they are heavily reliant on companies such as Intel and NVIDIA, which manufacture GPUs. They're also heavily reliant on companies like Xilinx, which manufacture another chip called the FPGA. And then there are also in the arena of storage solutions, there's companies such as Western Digital and Seagate, where proof has emerged that since about 2005 or so, companies such as Seagate have been working to develop surveillance hard drives with the Chinese government, and their technology is being purchased either through contractors or directly by China's Ministry of Public Security to develop surveillance hard drives for storing surveillance footage coming out of China. And I'm sure that there are many more companies that are out there that have yet to be discovered, but I would really encourage more future work on this to discover the exact extent of this web of not only US companies, such as the ones that I have just mentioned, but also companies in Europe and companies beyond Europe that are involved in exporting equipment to China's surveillance state.
So you mentioned in particular surveillance storage, and I guess I'm a little curious, what's particular about storage that makes it surveillance storage? Is it that it's super large in capacity or a particular form factor or?
Right. So Seagate and Western Digital, they have both released surveillance hard drives that they say are marketed towards AI surveillance specifically. I think where that differs is just in the sense of processing power and the amount that you can store, but also just increasing the seamless connection between the edge and the cloud, as that is something that is very important for surveillance, that you need those rapid fire decision times and you need to reduce that latency. So I think those are the main differences. Besides then, if you have something like a Seagate storage drive for just backing up files on your computer, that's a much smaller use case than if you're actually trying to connect the flow of data from various surveillance cameras and keep them stored within this physical hard drive.
Right. And that all makes good sense and logical argumentation for why you would want a different type of storage. But at the same time, I guess it kind of undermines the notion that some of this, although perhaps directly marketed in that area, really is, I won't say benign, but unwitting perhaps in some way, because these are characteristics that are probably important for other large data purposes as well.
Yes, absolutely. I think like one area that may be a little bit self-defeating in that sense for marketing is that they clearly identify this as AI surveillance in the sense that that in itself markets itself as a bit less of a benign use case, at least in my opinion.
True enough. So what do you think needs to be done in order to at least mitigate the harmful implications of aiding misuse of the technology? Is it a regulatory issue, such as barring the export of certain components to police states, or what do you think are the right steps?
Right. That's a fantastic question. So one thing that I think should be done is at the moment, the State Department has released, as of last October, they released draft export guidance for surveillance companies that would be exporting surveillance equipment to countries like China or Iran or beyond. And that regulation, I think, in that it's not a regulation, I think it does not really have enough teeth to really pose as an actual export control, as at the end of the day, it is draft guidance. So I think that doesn't do quite enough to really put the burden on companies to just do their own due diligence. It doesn't actually serve as an export control. I think more work needs to be done by both the State Department and the Department of Commerce, along with the NGO space and the think tank space, to really dig in and do more work on the supply chain web that exists between the US, other companies, and other countries, and in China, to see which companies are actually involved. One thing that I think is promising that has been coming out of the US is that it seems that Congress is paying very close attention to this issue on the domestic front. I think just a few days ago, there was new legislation announced. I think it's called the National Biometric Information Privacy Act, and that is modeled off of Illinois' successful legislation in that regard, that private companies would need to get people's written consent to collect biometric data. And that would likely put an end to certain abusive private sector uses, such as auto tagging, facial recognition, and also the use of facial recognition in home cameras, both of which are private sector uses. Beyond that, I would advocate for the National Science Foundation to fund more research into privacy-preserving methods. There has been a promising research that has come out recently from the University of Chicago that is called FOX, named after Guy Fawkes, that takes pixels from someone's face, a celebrity's face, that does not look like yours, implements that into your face, and then essentially creates a face that is almost undetectable to the naked eye, but will not be able to be accurately tagged by automated facial recognition technology by services such as Facebook or other facial recognition systems. So those are just a few recommendations, but I'm heartened by the fact that there is a lot more attention being paid to these issues, and it seems that regulation in some form or another will be forthcoming.
So it sounds like, as you've touched on the kinds of things that people are doing in order to try to, you know, circumvent facial recognition, it kind of highlights the fact that there for all the advances made, the technology is still plagued by technical issues. And additionally, there are issues with false positives and even charges of biased algorithms. Can you talk a bit more about what some of these challenges are and sort of how serious the charges of things like biased algorithms are?
Yes, absolutely. So while I do think there are some merited uses of facial recognition, overall, I think the costs far outweigh the benefits of the technology. The most important thing that I think the issue lies in with facial recognition is that there is really no more meaningful expectation of privacy. So as many have said, it's easy to change a password. It's not that easy to change your face. And a lot of the time, given that you cannot really tell that you're being surveilled and there is no adequate public notice that you are being subject to facial recognition, the ramifications of this can be quite severe. So when you're talking about biased algorithms, it is very true that facial recognition does have biased algorithms. It has clearly demonstrated itself through numerous studies to be an immature yet still widely deployed technology that essentially fails to accurately identify women and people of color. And this is especially the case with Black women. And these findings are quite extensive. They have been done by researchers at MIT. They were also recently confirmed by NIST. I think one pretty shocking point here is that you can see that researchers at NIST pointed out that these algorithms falsely identified Black and Asian faces 10 to 100 times more than Caucasian faces. So you may wonder here, so why is this the case? Why is there such a stark difference? The reason is essentially based because the facial recognition industry has not yet overcome its bias issue. So data sets are mostly white and mostly male. I think New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I think she really nailed it when she spoke at a congressional hearing last year, and she said, and I quote, "We have a technology that was created and designed by one demographic that is mostly effective on that one demographic, and they're trying to sell it and impose it on the entirety of the country." And so when you have this inherently biased technology that is still widely deployed, you do indeed have a high rate of false negatives. So when the correct image is in the database but is not successfully identified, or you have, on the other hand, you have false positives. So you are incorrectly identified as someone else. And I think one of the biggest issues when it comes to things like false positives is that people could be suspected for crimes that they simply did not commit. And this would really force and it would put the burden on innocent people to jump through hoops to try to prove their innocence. And even if they do prove their innocence, one thing that really comes out here is there is a really significant lack of remedial policy. So if you are arrested, you are entered into a mugshot database, you clear yourself of all charges, you show that you are innocent, you don't even really get to have your day in court beforehand to even determine that guilt or innocence before your face already lands on one of these mugshot databases, and then it lives on in there to be scanned again at any time.
So there's a couple things I'd like to sort of pause and drill into there. One, you talk about the fact that the data sets are typically, you know, for one particular slice of the population, and once trained on that slice, they're applied to the whole population with significantly poorer results for those of us who diverge from that slice. But it's curious to me in identifying that Asian faces are ones that are particularly not well identified in that, because it strikes me that the Chinese then must be using different data sets, because I'm presuming that much of the facial recognition that the Chinese are doing are in fact on Asian populations.
Yes, absolutely. So this, I believe when NIST is speaking about this aspect, that they're talking about American facial recognition companies. Certainly Chinese facial recognition companies, in general, when they are benchmarked by NIST, they enjoy high accuracy rates across the board, regardless of race. And I think part of the reason for that is there is one Chinese company called CloudWalk that was shown to have inked a partnership with the Zimbabwean government, and in exchange for the government database access to these Zimbabweans' faces. So whatever they are actually doing behind the scenes to train their algorithms, they are clearly doing something right, because they, at the end of the day, perform better than most American facial recognition companies across the board, regardless of race.
So the other thing that I wanted to follow up on was, you talk about what happens if you are tagged by a facial recognition system and you're dropped into a mugshot database before your day in court. Some of that, I think, has to do, is really dependent on the jurisdiction in which the facial recognition is being applied, because presumably that varies considerably from country to country as well.
Yes. I haven't personally looked into the mugshot database policies of specific countries, so unfortunately, I don't think I can really speak to that in detail.
Sure, and I think it just highlights another area in which mitigations in the use of facial recognition for identifying people in populations for law enforcement purposes, one of the mitigations is presumably to properly manage the handling of that data as part of the overall due process.
Right. I would absolutely second that.
So we've talked, I talked earlier about some of the potentially, at least seemingly harmless uses of the technology. For example, allowing me to get into my iPhone without necessarily having to remember a long passcode or series of numbers. What are some of the, let's talk about some of the good uses of the technology to counterbalance some of the misuse of that.
Sure. So there are certainly good use cases of facial recognition technology, while at the end of the day, I still come down on the side that these benefits don't necessarily outweigh these costs. There are still certain cases. Indeed, there is a great deal of convenience that you can get from if you are just on social media and Facebook does the auto-tagging of photos for you. Certainly, unlocking your phone is another major convenience, and one where, in the case of Face ID with Apple, they err on the side of trying to protect you. So they calibrate their settings to allow for higher false negative rates rather than false positives, so someone who is not you gets to unlock your phone. The funny thing here is that if I could talk to Apple about this, I would say that I have a fraternal twin sister and we are both at home together working from home, and we discover that our faces fool each other's face ID. So we try to trust each other and we have to go off the honor system, but
right.
That is one thing that Apple has not yet overcome, is with twins' faces.
How interesting.
I have
to say that I am really reticent, you know, with the Facebook feature of tagging phones, tagging photos. And the whole idea, I've not really bought onto the selfie culture, and potentially I'm one of the very few in the minority, but it
we're
really
dinosaurs,
does,
Alexa.
We're yeah, we're dinosaurs. But it really does make me uncomfortable to, from a privacy perspective, to have my pictures tagged by somebody else that, you know, perhaps I may not even see the notification. Facebook does give you notification if you set it that way. But, you know, in all the things that we do every day, I may not even see it. So there's also privacy implications of the use of facial recognition technology. And I guess the question is, like you said, you know, are there are some benefits, but the downside of it, do they really overcome the benefits enough?
Right. And certainly in the perspective of auto-tagging features, I'm speaking from the perspective of the average consumer who would find that to be a great convenience to their lives. Certainly privacy concerns there do exist, whether that's what Facebook is doing with that in the background that we are not entirely aware of, or in the cases of companies like Clearview AI, where we saw that they decided to flout the user agreements of Twitter and Facebook and other companies to go ahead and lift all of, to scrape all of those photos themselves and then funnel them into facial recognition services that they then offered on the sly to police departments, both in the US and outside the US. So I believe Clearview had also offered a free trial to the Australian Federal Police. And then later they discontinued this free trial, but there are certainly privacy considerations to be held with this. I personally do not use Facebook and I do not agree with this feature. But at the end of the day, it's it is seen more as a convenience from the perspective of the average consumer.
Yes, I read an article in New York Times where it talked about banning the technology. And some of the, it didn't necessarily name these sort of tenants, but some of the cases for banning the technology include, you mentioned, you know, the violation to our right to privacy, but also the fact that it doesn't give us the opportunity for consent. With Clearview, for example, you know, certainly none of the folks whose image was scraped had the opportunity to consent. There's another principle, it's actually a UN principle that is recognized. It's of necessity and proportionality. In other words, the that use should be proportional to the impact, right? So the use of facial recognition technology should really be restricted to battling crime, but I suspect it's very hard to kind of restrict it that way. So do you think it really, are we talking about ultimately after playing around with it and seeing some of the conveniences coming to the conclusion that we really ought to ban it?
I would say that at the very minimum, we should put a moratorium on the technology and its use, both in the sense of federal law enforcement's use of that, but also on the private sector use of that. So there is a patchwork of legislation that is being floated in Congress that tackles both sides of this. I think given the facial recognition technology's proclivity for its use to be applied to minority communities, that there really does not exist in my mind any justification for any reason that these communities, which have already historically suffered so much, should be put under the watch of increased scrutiny and decreased semblance of any privacy that they can enjoy outside of their homes. So we already see this with policing practices that have clearly been historically biased. And you already see that criminal databases already include a disproportionate number of African Americans, Latinos, and immigrants. So by extension of that, facial recognition and any of these whiz-bang tools that the police are adopting, such as predictive policing, these are already more likely to target these groups to an even greater degree than they already are.
Right.
And again, then there's a significant lack of remedial policy, where if you're trying to fight for your own innocence, the burden is really placed upon you as someone who shouldn't have been affected in the first place to clear yourself of any wrongdoing that you really did not.
Mm-hmm. So the burden is placed on you to basically say, this is not me. This was not me.
Right, right. And and there really is no easy channel by which that you can do this. Often the attention is only really placed more squarely on these companies when you see stories in the media, such as, I think about less than a month ago, there was a story of someone who was misidentified and the hoops that he had to go through to prove that this wasn't him. And that this is absolutely something that can become commonplace if facial recognition technology is just deployed without any clear oversight. I do think that there really is no clear accuracy rate that I could promote here, since companies, yeah. It's all calibrated differently depending on which company. So there's really no apples to apples comparison that you can do here. But at the very least, when we have proof from both academia and through federal studies that the technology is so immature and so inaccurate on broad swaths of our population, I really don't see any reason why it should continue to be deployed and cleanup to be done after the harmful effects have been done.
Right. So you're talking really not just about the bias, but the accuracy rate of the technology. And you're saying, depending on the vendor, for example, you really can't get a good baseline of the accuracy.
Right. Yeah. And it is good that there are federal studies done by NIST to look at the accuracy of this, but to my understanding, it is still a voluntary submission by these companies who want to get their algorithms vetted. So it still remains difficult for outside researchers to really get a good peer into these systems by themselves.
So I mean, those are compelling arguments, and I'm reminded of, as security cameras in general became more commonplace, over the last few decades. And I mean, originally people were very concerned about, you know, you're spying on me, how can you be watching me? There are cameras everywhere, it's terrible. I think we mostly agreed to keep them out of bathrooms, mostly. I remember seeing a billboard. I was driving in Montreal at one point, and I saw a billboard that said something to the effect of, you're on camera 30 times a day. And I thought it was going to be the punchline, was going to be basically, you know, this is terrible, we should do something about it. No, the punchline was, so you should look your best. I mean, I think it was a dental ad or something, you know. So, but the point being that, you know, the technology is deployed over time. People's expectations of privacy and whatever come to adjust to it, if you will. Mm. So on one hand, I could ask the question, and perhaps I actually will. I could ask the question: is this likely to happen with facial recognition? The people who feel that their privacy is being taken from them because they're being spied on by these cameras will eventually just get used to it. On the other hand, part of what you're saying is it's not just like, you know, a physical film, right? It's the inferences that are being used and acted on. And we don't have visibility into how the decisions are made to map this particular image to that particular person. And without that visibility, there is no transparency. Is that a fair differentiation?
Yes, absolutely. I would agree with that. And as to your question about, are we just going to get used to that? That really depends on the perception of the average consumer. It seems that in the US at least, and I would wager in other countries, that more and more consumers are sounding the alarm over their growing discomfort over the widespread deployment of facial recognition technology. But at the end of the day, there's a little bit of a double standard here, because when it comes to, I believe that these consumers are more concerned about, say, like federal law enforcement or local law enforcement's use of facial recognition technology. But facial recognition technology is certainly present to a great degree in our private lives as well. So there are many people who find it okay to use Google's Nest products, which uses facial recognition in some of its products. There's also Amazon's Ring, which has a lot of police partnerships. I believe it has over 700. And that, while that does not currently use facial recognition technology, we really can't wave away the possibility that eventually Amazon, which also has their own facial recognition wing in its company Recognition, we cannot deny that at one point it is possible that recognition will be incorporated into Ring products. And that in itself is another layer of deteriorating users' privacy, because it allows police to request video data from users during police investigations. So you could just be taking a walk in someone's neighborhood and then you would be netted into a police investigation simply because you were in the wrong place at the wrong time, so to speak, even if you were doing absolutely nothing wrong. There's also been anecdotal reports of Ring users when they are using the neighborhood app that has contributed to racial profiling, that people reported on these apps that have been captured by Ring cameras disproportionately are Black and brown people. And this is despite the fact that Ring employees try to do moderation and they are trained to help moderate and monitor community boards to try to weed out instances of racial profiling and discriminatory practices being aired on these apps. But it is possible that in other areas such as marketing or monitoring your behavior in stores and then changing the displays or changing advertisements in real time based on how you are acting in the store, like what products you're looking at. These are things that are being considered and are being piloted in places in the US and beyond. There was this currently, as I see it, fairly creepy company called Cooler Screens that targets specific ads to you on the glass door of of the beverage section of certain stores to see what you're staring at in that moment and try to tailor that in real time to what they think you should buy or what they think you should pair your purchase with.
Wait, so if I'm going to 7-Eleven, yeah, this is kind of freaking me out. Yeah. So if I'm going to 7-Eleven and I want to open up the beverage section and buy like a Nestle iced tea, this knows what I am eyeing and would say, hey, you're looking at Nestle iced tea. How about, you know, the sandwich that might go with it?
Yes. Yeah, so this is a real thing that is being considered. So this, apparently this is in Walgreens and it in certain Walgreens stores, and it may be seen elsewhere. When you mentioned 7-Eleven, there are countries in Australia, there's 7-Elevens in Australia that use facial recognition. I believe that's almost 1,000 stores, I mean, between 500 to 1,000 stores in Australia that use facial recognition for customer feedback. So they very stringently claim that they are not using facial recognition for when you're in the store itself, but only if you want to provide feedback at the end of your shopping experience, that you approach this tablet that allows you to, then facial recognition would be activated and you would put in your feedback. So I can't really imagine any consumer that would really feel comfortable giving their feedback in that kind of case, but there are certain cases that are being piloted at the moment that do this, and they sound very Minority Report, but if facial recognition continues to develop and there's no limits being placed on its private sector use, it's entirely possible that we may live in a world one day where we do go into the store and we have targeted advertisements delivered to us on the regular.
But for the feedback thing, I mean, to be fair, prior to all of this technology stuff, if you wanted to get feedback in a store, you went and you found the store manager who could see your face and you actually had the conversation. And since we've had, you know, online fora with comment sections and whatnot, part of the challenge is the fact that people leave comments, if not, you know, completely anonymously, reasonably anonymously, and thus say things that they never would say to a person face to face. So one could argue that the facial recognition on the feedback app is meant to sort of counterbalance that, so that the feedback you give is not just anonymous shouting at a tablet presented to you at the end of your less than optimal shopping experience. But when you started describing this, the worst scenario that I thought of is not being recommended a sandwich to go with an ST that you're eyeing, but rather it's like, you know, everything from, you know, good morning, Ms. Daigle. Wouldn't you like some gin to go with that vodka that you bought the other day?
Yeah. Right. I mean, no. We really don't know like where the limits are if we continue to just deploy this technology and if we also don't regulate in the regard that we say, like with the rated tablet, that you, while you're talking to a manager, that manager can't record your face print and remember who you are and tie your identity to you. But we don't really know in the case of if these are more widely deployed, what the terms are going to be around this in terms of data retention, or if they will sell that data to third-party users. It's kind of a wild west out there where without any clear guidelines, where we're going to open more of a Pandora's box that would, where your data could be used far beyond cases where you're just giving a manager some feedback.
It seems to me like the old adage, you know, that that technology is always far more advanced than regulation and policy. But I would extend that a little bit further. Technology is far more advanced than even our understanding of the implications and consequences, sort of like a stone being thrown in a pond and the ripple effect. Mm-hmm. So if we're going to try and wrap up, but if we were to look at this and say, what are our takeaways? What can we do now, today? What can we advocate for that will help lessen the impact or mitigate some of the risks so that, you know, when you were saying Pandora's box, I was thinking genie out of the bottle, right? I mean, have we lost it already? Is it already out there and we can't really recapture it? Or are there things that we can do right now to try and at least stave off some of the worst impacts?
Right. So I think to some extent the genie is out of the bottle, but if Congress were to act on a national level, which would both in the sense that they have bills that deal with the law enforcement use of this and also the private sector use of this, that federal laws would then stipulate for a broader use that would overcome the piecemeal regulation that we are now seeing in the US, where it's really up to the city level or the state level. There are certain models that lawmakers have already adopted with the Illinois Biometric Privacy Act, that has now just been adopted as a template for the National Biometric Privacy Act. And again, that would require private companies to get written consent to collect biometric data. And it would also stipulate standards for the use and the retention of data collected for these systems, and that they would provide benchmarks for accuracy rates, and that they would aim to not be used, not have restrictive uses in terms of tracking protesters, for instance, using facial recognition to avoid those impacts where you would have chilling effects. So there is the path where we could go on a full moratorium. I really don't know if that is possible, given that we have very strong lobbying efforts by some of these companies. It is commendable that some of these companies, like Microsoft and Amazon, they have either agreed to withdraw themselves completely from the police facial recognition market, or at least do that temporarily, where they are kicking the ball over to Congress and saying, well, if you regulate this within the next year, in that meantime, we are not going to sell to police. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, I would really advocate for a moratorium in the most ideal of circumstances and put an end to the widespread deployment of this, either in local policing or in national efforts or by private sector. That would be a significant effort to actually overcome and roll back the deployments of this, but I do not think it would be impossible. If we raise those barriers high enough, as Illinois has done, then I think that there is much more of a promising use that facial recognition can be reined in to a healthier degree.
And stop some of the chilling effects.
Yes, yes. I think that is one of the most important things that we can do if we want to continue to enshrine our freedoms, is that we cannot have protesters feel that they cannot go voice their concerns on the streets without being tracked afterwards. So either they're being arrested in that moment, or they are then being followed up on. And that is really not a country that I think any of us would really want to live in.
Correct. Well, this has been very, very interesting and insightful. Thank you so much, Dahlia.
Yes, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.